Hello, I'm Lina Khmudu. Welcome to Health Chat. World Health Day was commemorated on April 7th with the theme My Health, My Right, emphasizing the fundamental connection between health and human rights. Experts say the right to health for all people means that everyone should have access to the health services they need when and where they need them, without suffering financial hardship. More than 4.5 billion people in the world did not have access to health services in 2021, including 600 million in Africa, according to the World Health Organization. And health challenges such as non-communicable diseases, mental health disorders, and maternal mortality continue to claim life disproportionately in marginalized communities. For more on the subject, I spoke with Dr. Taiwo Oyelade, Technical Officer for Gender, Equity and Human Rights at the WHO African Regional Office. Take a listen.
Dr. Taiwo Oyelade, thank you so much for joining us today. So World Health Day is on April 7th. Can you explain the significance of this year's theme, which is My Health, My Right? Why was it chosen?
Thank you very much for having me on your program. Around the world, the right to health of millions of people is increasingly coming under threat. We hear about conflicts, prolonged ones and acute ones, the effect of climate change, the effect of global warming, and all the impacts on health on people. And also, we know that, millions of vulnerable and disadvantaged people do not have access to good quality health care. So for this year's World Health Day, the theme, My Health, My Rights, was chosen to champion the right of everyone, everywhere to good quality health care.
And Dr. Taiwo, how does the WHO define the right to health, and what are its key components?
The right to health is the right to a set of social arrangements, including institutions, services, systems, and enabling environments that help people to be healthy. So the right to health is not only limited to right to health care, it encompasses rights to underlying social determinants of health, including good housing, clean water, energy, security, education, and so on and so forth. And these components of the right to health and the underlying determinants of health must be available in sufficient quantity, be accessible to everyone, financially, geographically, and others, and must be acceptable culturally to everyone. And it must be of good quality, safe and effective. So that is the what we mean when we talk about right to health and the components of right to health.
In your view, what are the biggest barriers to achieving health equity in Africa?
So in my view, the biggest barriers are about three or four. One is inability to have sufficient data that will allow us to know those who are actually left behind, who they are, where they live, what they do, and what can be done in order to bring them forward. That is one barrier. Two, the inability of people to be aware of their right to help is also a barrier. So they cannot demand for those rights in an effective manner. And then three, the lack of support from communities and civil societies to adequately those who are vulnerable and disadvantaged to to demand for their right to help. Those are the three barriers that I can readily talk about now.
And could you share some examples of how health inequities manifest in different parts of the continent?
Yes. If we start from the area of access to health, for example, we can take the popular one, the reproductive, maternal, newborn, and child death interventions. We know that the people who are, you know, who have the lowest coverage of the effective proven interventions are people who live in rural areas, the poor people, the lowest 20% quintile in the economic ladder. People are not educated, and people who live in hard-to-reach areas. So again, people who suffer from one form of disability or the other, and including those who are, you know, battling with mental health and psychological issues, those are the people that are, you know, inequitably covered. And they're the ones that are left behind. If we use the example of reproductive, maternal, newborn, and child death, this is also interventions, including, you know, malaria interventions. The households, the poorest households, are the households who do not have sleep under impregnated bed nets that will help them to, you know, prevent mosquito bites. And they are the ones who have environments where the breeding of mosquitoes, which causes the malaria, is most rampant. And they're the ones who do not have health facilities very close by, you know, for treatment and for prevention services. So these are a few examples of how, you know, health inequity play out around the region.
So how can individuals and communities get involved in advocating for their health rights?
Yeah, individuals and communities have a very important role to play in order to, you know, create awareness and to build capacity for people to demand rights to health. The first important area where they can play a vital role is in, you know, popularizing the right to health. Individuals and communities can let people know that they have the right to health. It is not a luxury. This is something that has been set in the international instruments that is, you know, ascended to by all the countries in the region, and they are making adequate efforts in order to help the right holders to realize this health. But they also need the capacity to be able to know their rights and to demand for fulfillment of these rights. So individuals and communities can play a very important role in this area. We can also help in, you know, supporting our evidence to understand those who are left behind, to know where they are, to know who they are, to know what barriers they face, and to also work together to, in order to co-create remedial actions that we can implement together with the people that we have identified that are left behind. These actions, when we co-create with the, you know, the vulnerable and the disadvantaged groups, they have become very practical. They are owned by everyone, and they can be easily implemented at the community level with, you know, concrete results coming out of it.
What role do governments and policymakers play in ensuring the realization of the right to health for their populations?
Yeah, policymakers, they have a most important role to play in that regard. One, they have taken the first bold step by accepting to the, you know, the treaties and the conventions which are related to right to health. So they have to go a step further. A lot of countries are already doing that. including rights to health in their constitutions, and also developing policies and programs integrating a human rights-based approach. So this should be, you know, expanded to cover all the countries. So all countries should have in their instruments, including the constitution, right to health. They should have policies, programs and strategies towards advancing the right to health. And they should also build capacity of, individuals and communities in order for them to realize the right to health. And most especially, they now have to address the issue of right to health in an holistic and multi-sectoral manner, and not only vertical within their program, but by involving the, you know, other programs to address the issue of health emergencies and conflicts, address issues of climate change, address issues of, emerging digital technology with impact on rights. They have to do this in an holistic manner in order to, you know, address, to show that health is really a right and that they are ready to support individuals and communities in order to achieve these rights.
And finally, Dr. Taiwo, what are the key priorities for WHO in promoting the right to health as part of its agenda?
Yeah, for the WHO, as you are aware, WHO's constitution, specifically stated that everyone everywhere should have rights to, you know, quality health care, irrespective of their race, their religion, their class, their socioeconomic status. So this is in line with the, you know, Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which has highlighted the right to health. And in this regard, WHO is integrating the human rights-based approach to health within its support to member states, highlighting that we should not leave anyone behind by supporting, assessments to, you know, identify the gaps in policies, strategies, and programs, to identify the vulnerable groups that are left behind, to, you know, convene partners, including communities and civil society organizations and other developmental partners, in order to, you know, come up with acceptable and homegrown solutions to contextual gender equity and human rights issues, which are impacting the right to health. And then, apart from the assessments and policy support, we also support, programmatic implementation, and we have to monitor to ensure that, all people, everyone, everywhere, are covered by the, by health programs and the multi-sectoral actions that are supporting people in order to achieve their rights to health.
Dr. Taiwo Oyelade, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
That is Dr. Taiwo Oyelade, Technical Officer for Gender, Equity and Human Rights at the WHO African Regional Office. You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It's time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Health Chat. The human papillomavirus, or HPV, is the most common sexually transmitted infection. Many people with HPV, don't develop any symptoms, but can still infect others through sexual contact. Experts say persistent HPV infection of the cervix, if left untreated, causes 95% of cervical cancers. A top Namibian health official tells VOA the Southern Africa country is set to begin distribution of the HPV vaccine to adolescent girls as a preventative measure in the fight against cervical cancer. Vitalio Angula reports from Windhoek, Namibia.
Nearly all cervical cancers are linked to genital infection with HPV. The HPV vaccine is the first that directly addresses sexual and reproductive health. Although Namibia lags behind several other African countries in rolling out the HPV vaccine, health authorities see it as necessary to combat sexually transmitted infections, which are quite common. Speaking at the event, the acting executive at the Ministry of Health, Taimi Amambo, said the vaccinations for HPV will be more complex compared to the immunizations against rubella and tetanus, which are administered to infants. She explained how the decision came about.
The NITAG, which is the National Immunization Technical Advisory Group, was established in May last year, 2023, and it conducted the scientific evidence to recommendations process and provided a strong recommendation to the ministry on the motivation why we need to roll out and introduce HPV vaccine as part of our current EPI, expanded schedule program for immunization, for the 9 to 14 years age group.
The vaccine is administered through an injection in the muscles of the arm or thigh. Women's health and social entrepreneur Neveline Amwenye says HPV vaccinations do not treat HPV but are rather a preventative tool in minimizing infection. She told VOA Africa that HPV is common in both males and females. Most people will contact HPV at least once in their lifetime, which the body can clear out, but can sometimes lead to precancer.
HPV vaccines can prevent infection with certain types of HPV, including types that are linked to HPV-related cancers, as well as types linked to anal and genital warts. Vaccines are approved for use in males and females. They can only be used to prevent HPV infection. They do not help treat an existing infection, which is important to note.
The First Lady of Namibia, Monica Genkos, who is also the president of the Organization of African First Ladies, has been mobilizing efforts across Africa for the introduction of HPV vaccines in adolescent girls. She says in Africa, cervical cancer is a major health concern for women, representing 20% of all cancers diagnosed among them and coming in only second to breast cancer.
Left with no choice but to do things differently. Reducing the number of women who die from cervical cancer has always been urgent. It makes no sense that the cervical cancer disease burden continues to increase while cervical cancer is probably the only truly preventable cancer. The scaling up of prevention for both HIV and HPV programs needs new and innovative approaches. There is the real risk of losing ground in gains made, but there is also the real opportunity in sustaining them.
Rwanda became the first country on the continent to introduce HPV vaccine in 2011 and has achieved a 98% vaccination rate through its school-based program. South Africa introduced the HPV vaccine in 2014, while it was introduced in Burkina Faso in April 2022. The vaccine was set to be introduced in Namibia but was delayed due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The country plans to roll it out early next year. For VOA Africa, I'm Vitalio Angula from Windhoek, Namibia.
For more pregnant women in the slums of Nairobi, ultrasound services are an affordable luxury. Now, a Kenyan healthcare business is using portable, low-cost ultrasound systems to give expecting mothers a chance to see their babies and detect any health problems before the delivery day. Victoria Amunga reports from Nairobi.
Sophia Ameida is looking at her fetus for the first time at this clinic in Kenya's Mukuru Kwa Ruben slum. Ameida is due in a few weeks. She says getting an ultrasound is critical for her because her first baby was delivered by cesarean section.
They could not tell how the baby was positioned. At the time of my delivery, the baby was still way up and was not moving down at all, so I had to go for surgery.
For most women in Kenyan slums, often called informal settlements, this type of medical technology is out of reach. One session can cost as much as $60. But with a relatively new ultrasound device called a butterfly probe, patients like Amida can get an ultrasound for just $10. The device is designed by the US-based health tech company Butterfly Network. The probe can connect to a tablet or a mobile phone, making it portable and easy to use for sonographers like Alfred Kibet.
It enables you to reduce the cost of doing ultrasound, because you see with the other traditional machines, ultrasound machines, they are quite expensive, and again, the other components involved, like you need a printer, a special printer. And so, but with this, you can just store the images and then you can print with a regular printer.
Healthcare companies like Access Afia are partnering to provide the devices to clinics, especially in densely populated areas. The goal is to close the gap of affordable healthcare, says Access Afia's finance director, Danny McCabe.
They don't need to be focused on how do I get a payback immediately on this machine, and be focused on, hey, how do I make the highest price possible for these machines? You can be focused on providing the best level of care and then working with us to make sure there's enough foot traffic here to make sure that at the end of the day, everyone's able to make their money back on the machine.
Kenya has among the world's highest rates of maternal deaths, according to UN figures. Nurse midwife Millie Karina says ultrasounds can help to detect and avert most difficulties at birth, like when a woman is carrying twins.
Sometimes I've found that we're in labor with a mom, but we didn't know there were two. We thought it was one, but there are two. So that can complicate things a little bit for the mom, not knowing. Number two, mothers have lost pregnancies because the placenta was insufficient. And it could something that could have been picked up really early, but unfortunately, it happens.
Kenyan healthcare providers believe that lower costs of medical technologies like ultrasound will help to lower infant and maternal death. Victoria Amunga, VOA News, Nairobi.
The World Food Programme reports a convoy of desperately needed food aid has reached the war-wracked Darfur region for the first time in months. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN World Food Programme reports two convoys crossed the border from Chad into Darfur in late March. They were carrying food and nutrition assistance for around 250,000 people in northwest and central Darfur. Lenny Kinsley, the WFP communications officer for Sudan, expresses relief that lengthy negotiations to reopen these routes have paid off. But she warns unless the people of Sudan receive a constant flow of aid through all possible humanitarian corridors, the country's hunger catastrophe will only worsen.
Cross-border operations from Chad to Darfur are so critical to reach communities where children are already reported to be dying of malnutrition. All corridors to transport food must remain open, particularly the one from Adre in Chad to West Darfur, where levels of hunger are alarming.
She adds the delivery of aid into other parts of Darfur through the Tin border crossing or across conflict lines from within Sudan must become quicker and easier. Since war between the Sudanese armed forces and paramilitary rapid support forces erupted a year ago, the United Nations reports more than 8.5 million people have become displaced, 6.5 million within the country. WFP reports 18 million are facing acute hunger, 90% of them in hard-to-reach areas. Speaking from Nairobi today, Kensley says lengthy clearance processes for humanitarian cargo, bureaucratic red tape and security threats are making it impossible for aid workers to provide help to people trapped in Sudan's conflict hotspots.
WFP needs aid to be consistently reaching war-ravaged communities through every possible route. Hunger in Sudan will only increase as the lean season starts in just a few weeks. Our greatest fear is that we will see unprecedented levels of starvation and malnutrition sweep across Sudan this lean season, and that the Darfur region will be particularly hard hit.
She says she fears the lean season, which normally runs from May to September, could begin as early as next week and last much longer than usual. Kinsley explains crop production is at an all-time low because the fighting is preventing farmers from harvesting their crops. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Since the end of last month, more than a dozen countries in the WHO African region have documented probable or confirmed cases of yellow fever. Dr. William Komachesh, WHO epidemiologist for infectious disease control in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam the overall number of confirmed cases is down from a year ago, but active surveillance is required due to the potential for transmission through travel and the presence of the mosquito vector in neighboring regions.
How many cases you have of yellow fever in Africa, the whole continent, and, you know, maybe break down where you're most concerned about outbreaks of yellow fever in certain countries?
Usually every year we provide information on the number of cases every year. This usually comes through the weekly WHO's weekly epidemiological record, but the report is released in the month of August. Those countries were Burkina Faso, Cameroon, Central African Republic, Chad, Congo, Cote d'Ivoire, DRC, Guinea, Niger, Nigeria, South Sudan, Uganda.
A lot of those countries that you just mentioned have conflict. If not a civil war, they have insurgencies going on and other things like that. Does that contribute to higher cases of yellow fever?
In a way, it could, in the sense that it could delay effective response. You know, we have seen that, for example, with the Central African Republic, where you find that the response vaccination campaigns tend to be delayed because sometimes of reasons related to, you know, security challenges. Transportation, for example, would be difficult. Supervision and, you know, deployment of the vaccines.
Is the number of fatal cases, would you say, down overall than it was a year ago?
Yes. In 2023, we didn't have, big disruptive outbreaks, which usually lead to a number of fatalities. There's been some reduction from 2020-21, where we had 18% fatality, to now estimated at about 11% for 2023. But you have to remember that yellow fever itself actually is a severe illness, which is often fatal.
What is the cause, you know, usually of the proliferation of yellow fever?
Well, yellow fever is transmitted by a mosquito vector. So let's say after the rainy season or in the midst of the rainy season, when the mosquito population proliferates, you tend to get increases in the number of cases. The disease is mainly a disease of the wild animals, the monkeys, the the baboons. So situations that increase, you know, contacts between humans and the animals in the wild, maybe, you know, expansion in settlements, activities like artisanal mining, lumber, opening new roads, hunting, for example, could also lead to, you know, cases of yellow fever because it will increase contacts between the vectors in the wild, which probably could be infected, and then the humans that are not, particularly those not protected by vaccination.
What does the WHO do to fight the proliferation of yellow fever or try to eradicate it?
It's probably not possible at the moment to eradicate yellow fever because it's a disease that circulates in the wild. So what WHO does is to support member states where there is a risk of transmission to prevent outbreaks occurring through, number one, protecting the population that are at risk through vaccination. And then secondly, to try and prevent international spread, again, also through vaccinating and making sure that travelers from countries that are at risk or those going to countries that are at risk of yellow fever are vaccinated against yellow fever. And then thirdly, to make sure that in the event of an outbreak, the response is fast.
That is Dr. William Komachesh, WHO epidemiologist for infectious disease control. He was speaking with my colleague from Brazzaville in the Democratic Republic of Congo. That's all for this edition of Health Chat. Thank you all for joining us, and thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Linor Mudo, in Washington, with producer Mukbilia Barrow. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.